high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action today. So much going on. Michael Goodwin at the bottom of the hour. Senator Joni Ernst is going to be with us shortly. We're also looking at a bunch of things. We're going to have both candidates in action today. We're going to be talking to them. And we have three major stories to go through, as well as an election to go over. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
At the federal level, this has been a massive failure. And you can just ask the people there on the ground. I have been there. I was in Georgia. I was in Florida, where Hurricane Helene made landfall. FEMA has lost sight of its core mission, I think, in so many cases.
Yep, there you go. Hurricane Helene's power is still being evaluated as the damage across seven states and the needs that thousands are being met are not being met, especially in North Carolina. The media mysteriously has very few questions. I have plenty.
Number two.
Just 28% of Americans think the U.S. is on the right track. And I want you to put that into perspective, right? When does the average, when the incumbent party loses the election, look at that. It's just 25%. This, to me, is a bad sign for Kamala Harris's campaign.
That's on CNN, by the way. 2024, 29 days to go, as a risk-averse Harris is hearing it from her side, and Trump pulls off the rally of his run to date with a mammoth crowd over in Butler. We're going to look at the polls and the game plans.
Number one.
Do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
With all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people?
My hope,
and the answer to that question is yes.
My hope is that 60 Minutes says you can't adjust my questions. October 7th attacks in Israel, 1 year later, everything has changed. And what infuriates me is the protest planned in against Israel in New York City today. Hopefully it rains. And around the nation, too. Kamala Harris makes clear she does not look at Bibi as an ally. Why I believe Israel has to continue to escalate for peace. Senator Joni Ernst knows all about war, served in the military, and she is the chairman of the Republican Policy Committee and on Armed Services and ranking member on Small Business. Senator, welcome back. What are your thoughts, first off, 1 year later? That's what the vice president's talking about. Bibi is not an ally.
Oh, I think it's ridiculous, Brian. How dare she? This infuriates me. Israel is our closest ally in the Middle East. They are the only democracy in that region. There should be no daylight between our leadership and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We must enable them to decimate and defeat Hamas, and we need to enable them to defend their country against Iran. Iran is an enemy of the United States as well. We should never, ever forget that, Brian. So shame on Kamala Harris. She just continues to exhibit the weak leadership that we have seen in the past 4 years from President Biden as well.
Well, I mean, this is a key moment, too, because Hezbollah in Lebanon, we promised to give the people of Lebanon $157 million. Really? Can we make sure it's going to the right people?
My.
Because Hezbollah runs the government.
Gosh.
Are we going to give this money to Hamas? Because we continue to fund the Palestinians. So what kind of message is that? $100 million to North Carolina, $157 million to Lebanon.
Brian, oh my gosh. So this is the deal, is they continue to enable bad actors. And let's just take it straight to the top. Let's talk about Iran. Iran is the one that funds Hamas. They fund Hezbollah, the Houthis, Islamic Palestinian Jihad. You know, name all of these radical terrorist organizations in the Middle East. They all stem out of the funding pot of Iran. And who has allowed that to happen? Kamala Harris. She and President Biden have been appeasing Iran since day one of their administration. This horrible nuclear deal that they were trying to get back into, you know, that happened under President Obama. President Trump rightly took us out of that nuclear agreement. They have allowed him to continue to develop Iran, these nuclear not quite to nuclear weapons, but very, very close. They've allowed them to continue to sell illicit oil, which is to the tune of $100 billion of revenue for Iran to give to terrorist proxies. So let's just forget about sending all of this humanitarian aid for a moment. Let's focus on getting Iran back into the box that President Trump had them in. Starting with that, we can solve a lot of the issues in the Middle East.
I want you to hear what David Bellavia, Medal of Honor recipient, said about what Israel has done. While we wait for the hostages to get back, and they're doing everything possible, I believe, one battalion is left to have Hamas. And what they've done in dismantling the gold standard of terror organization Hezbollah has been stunning, and they're not done. Here's what David Bellavia told me on One Nation Saturday, Cut 7.
Israel has done in 11 months what our Congress and our Senate and our presidents would not allow our military to do, Brian, in 23 years. This is total war. You eliminate your enemies. And with all due respect to President Biden, we don't fight with proportionality when our citizens are being murdered.
You back that up?
Oh, I do. Absolutely. You know, if there are members of Congress, because I do want to point it out, there are those of us in Congress that absolutely believe that we should be enabling Israel to do everything possible to defeat Hamas and to push back against Iran. So there are those of us that are fighting diligently from that front. But as a veteran, as a combat veteran who served in the Middle East, believe me, you can't win a war by just drip, drip, dripping. And we've talked about this with Ukraine, too. You can't do it unless you allow a full-throated pushback and to the point of an offense against Iran and those terrorist proxies.
So you're passing a resolution. You're sponsoring a resolution to have the entire Senate introducing a resolution today to condemn the Hamas terrorist attacks against Israeli civilians. I mean, imagine on the Senate side, you might not get Bernie Sanders. And on the House side, if it gets to the House, so they do something similar, the whole squad's going to boycott that.
Oh, absolutely, Brian. And if you think back a year ago, I was actually in Saudi Arabia on the 6th, woke up on the morning of the 7th I had a delegation I was leading. Where? On the way to Israel. And we found out about the attacks. We were not allowed to go into Israel. I was finally able to get in on the 10th of October. But President Biden and the White House and the State Department, they were fighting me every step of the way. They did not want me to go into Israel with my delegation, but we fought back. Why? Because it's important that we were there at a moment of crisis with the leadership in Israel to say, we are with you. We stand with you. In their moment of hurt, right, the United States of America should have been there embracing them. So I was glad to get in on the 10th with my delegation, but President Biden was nowhere to be found.
So I want you to hear with Governor Tim Walz, who is the running mate of Kamala Harris. She will not, like he and she will not commit to backing up Israel. They say the words, but their actions say everything. Listen, cut 4.
This administration continues to call for Israel to moderate its response after being attacked by Iran. Do you now think that Israel has a right to either strike oil facilities, nuclear facilities? What's your position on that?
Well, look, let's remember how this started, and we're approaching tomorrow a tragic anniversary. Hamas terrorists murdered over 1,200 innocent Israelis, 46 Americans, took hostages. We have been clear. Israel has the right to defend itself. We've always stood in that position. We need the hostages returned. And we need to bring an end to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. But again, the point is it's Iran is at the heart of this and their proxies that bring disruption throughout the region.
He will not commit to retaliation against Iran, even though it's saying they're at the heart of it.
Oh, my gosh, Brian. Oh, you and I know different. We need to make sure Israel is going after Iran. And as their friend and ally, we should be supporting them in everything they do. Iran has open assassination plots against our former administration leaders, including President Trump. And what do we do about it? As Tim Walz rightly pointed out, you know, Iran's proxies killed Americans. Iran has targeted American troops in the Middle East, three that were killed in January of this year. And yet we have done absolutely nothing about it.
I know.
What are we going
Houthi
to do?
Houthi rebels shut down the Red Sea. That, this is our fight, too. Why? Like they just had a speech. He said, death to America is not a slogan. It's a policy. So what are we waiting for while they've killed thousands of our guys over the years in Iraq? Lastly, on this election, being that we're in a virtual dead heat, closest since 2000, but Trump's polls so gets more votes than he does than he appears in the polls. He underpolls. This is what Andrea Mitchell obviously wants Donald Trump not to be president again, said about Harris. Cut 15.
They've got to double down on doing more interviews and serious interviews. Because what I'm hearing from Democratic and Republican business people and a lot of men, and she's got such a big problem with men. I think there's an undercount of the Trump vote. I think there's miscegenation in all of this, black and white men. Big problem, but also the business world. They don't think she is serious. They don't think she's a heavyweight. And a lot of this is gender, but she's got to be more specific about her economic plans.
I say that every day. I mean, what would impress you? When is she ever impressed talking about the economy, talking about the military, or not reading the prompter? And that to me is desperation for Andrea Mitchell to say that on a Sunday show.
Yeah, it tells you that there are people on the left that are even concerned about a Harris presidency. Why? Because she has waffled away the last three plus years of the administration doing absolutely nothing, not taking the time to understand the issues that are most important to Americans, whether it's our economy, whether it's her time as the border czar, you know, with a wide open border, and very importantly to our country and our country's safety, the safety of our people, our national security. You ask her anything about our Department of Defense, our military, the men and women that are serving this country. She knows absolutely nothing, Brian.
I know.
There is nothing in that head that would enable her to be a strong commander-in-chief.
Not that I've seen. She's hiding it well. We'll see. She might have to come out of the COVID cave and come out and compete and do real interviews. I don't know what 60 Minutes yielded, but unless they ask the real questions, they're going to pay a price. And I don't blame Trump for not doing it. So, Senator, thanks so much for doing that resolution today. And hopefully Israel's going to allow it to finish the job.
God bless them. Thanks so much, Brian.
Senator Joni Ernst, thanks. So when we come back, your calls, 1-866-408-7669. I look forward to hearing what you have to say. And then Michael Goodwin at the bottom of the hour. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It is really hard to imagine that there's something between now and Election Day that is going to change the opinion of people. It's just a matter of who shows up. And if you look at a state like Michigan, for example, where Harris just was, and you look at the impact that the war in the Middle East is having on the Arab American community, that is a turnout question right now. If that population does not turn out and vote for Democrats, you can see that state swinging very quickly. And it's pockets like that across all these battleground states that I think are going to be the most significant aspect.
And that is Julie Pace on This Week with George Stephanopoulos. He is just so angry and deranged against Trump. All the guy talks about is January 6th. That's it. 2020 election, January 6th. Butler event, 60 to 80,000. Elon Musk there, most impactful man in the world, the modern day Benjamin Franklin, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison. That's not his headline. What's happening with Helene, not a headline to him. All he cares about is January 6th. And the look on his face is so angry. But the people, I'm telling you, January 6th will have nothing to do with this election. And whatever has been done has been done. Got the nomination, had the general, been shot, two assassination attempts. So many things have happened in between. I believe that if, and I think that Harris believes it more than Biden ever believed it, that January 6th is not going to work. They're going to roll some things out about Jack Smith, but nobody cares. You had your primetime show. You have your Liz Cheney. You're barnstorming the country with Liz Cheney. Also, there's a report in Politico that people on the left are really upset that her schedule is way too light and she has way too many meetings and not enough appearances. Wow. Here's Senator Fetterman on Pennsylvania. And after seeing 60 to 80,000 come out in Butler, you got to see these pictures. You make your own judgment and see how smooth and impactful that speech was. Listen to what he said. Cut 19.
Let's talk about Pennsylvania, and it's going to be very competitive. And that's another fact, that the American economy is the world's envy. And now 250,000 new jobs and inflation has been put in check, and things continue to get better and better on that. And it's going to be very, very close. In 2020, I put out a picture of the Butler rally from Trump. Mm-hmm. And Dallas said it's going to be very close in 2020, and then it was. And now back he was in Butler, and it's the same thing, and nothing has changed.
So he's saying it's going to be tough, but the problem is inflation is coming. Inflation rate is going down, but the prices never went down. They went up to the 9%, and the growth was slower in future months, like now. I think it's at 3-point-something percent. But it doesn't mean the prices have gone down from the base in which it shot up. That's what he's missing, or he's choosing to miss. But he does say that this guy is strong, and we do know that since 2016, they've added 300,000 Republicans in there. So, excuse me, the gap between Republicans and Democrats has gone down 300,000. So this is going to be a big deal. Now they say it's 48-48. If you underpoll Trump, and if you say North Carolina's tied at 48-48, if you say he's got a 4-point lead in Arizona, a 2-point lead in Georgia, which is all true. If you look at Wisconsin and say 2 points for Harris, if you look at Michigan and say 1 point for Harris, if you look at these blue wall, it's basically deadlocked. And everyone agrees that on the insiders, the pollsters, that Trump supporters do not respond well to this, and he always underpolls, you're in trouble. Nationally, the presidential race is a 3-point race on average. Trump's got 0.8%. This is according to the NBC poll. Arizona, Trump up 0.8. In Georgia, Trump up 1.6. In Michigan, they say on average, Trump, Harris up 2.7. But you see the trend is going down. In Pennsylvania, they're tied. In Wisconsin, it's 2.4. But the trend is going the other direction. So that's pretty significant. I just think what happened on Saturday is so underappreciated unless you took some time to watch it. You know, talking to Fox and Friends Weekend, who had Pete Hegseth on the ground, they just watched people coming almost as if it was a destination to show up, to show support for a guy that was almost killed if he didn't look just a little bit to his right. And also know the danger, because Corey Compentor is this firefighter legend, great family member, got killed shielding his family. Two others who still have a long way back to being whole again. So this is not one of those things where, well, all is good and it's done and forgiven because Trump only got hit in the ear. It's so much more than that. And let's hope that's the last of it. But my sense is it's not.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I think, with all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer to that question is yes.
Wow. You re-ask a question. A better question is, I didn't know that. So if you get a question you don't like, you could say, I tried this question on. Michael Goodwin joins us now, New York Post columnist. He wrote his column, It's Appropriate, coming up on 1 year since the October 7th attacks. Israel stands alone in the fight against terror 1 year after October 7th horrors. And Michael, it's true. We are supplying the weaponry, but we've always supplied the weaponry. We've asked them not to manufacture their own weapons. We've done it. They've made it better. They provide us with great intelligence. But suddenly, according to Mark Levin, we are slowing things up. We don't like their actions. I see a country going for victory. What are your thoughts?
Well, Brian, I think you're right that there has been this push and pull all along in the Biden-Harris administration. You recall that the president visited Israel, I think it was October 18th, so just 11 days after the October 7th invasion. And it was a morale booster. There wasn't a lot of substance to it, but it was a statement just by being there. And subsequently, the United States added ships to the region trying to deter Iran. But when you look back at the whole arc of it, you would have to say that this has been another failure of leadership in the White House. And I say that because Iran is the problem. Iran finances and directs Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Islamic Jihad, on and on and on. And Biden has rarely said a word about Iran. He has not done anything about the fact that the riches that he has effectively given to Iran through loosening the sanctions on oil, through buying hostages, through releasing frozen funds, that this is what's funding all of these groups. And so he has been very careful to not break with Israel, but he's not addressing the source of the problem, which is Iran. And so, therefore, I would have to say, ergo, that's why my column is titled Israel Stands Alone.
But what about what he just said?
Of course, is even worse.
What about what you just said? I'm not allies with Bibi. We're allies with the Israeli people. What are you talking about? I mean, we're allies with the Iranian people, too. But would you can put them in the same category? I have no problem with the Iranian people.
That's a very good point, Brian, that she's trying to avoid the question. Look, the Democrats hate Netanyahu. They always have. I mean, he is the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history, and the Democratic Party hates him. Obama hated him. Biden hates him. Harris has clearly inherited that hate. They clearly would prefer somebody, a Democrat type, in the government of Israel. And the darn people of Israel keep electing people the Democrats in Washington don't approve of. Now, so Harris is sort of over a barrel, which is why she changed the question. They see Netanyahu as the problem. The people of Israel, the majority of them, see him as the solution.
In some sects. I mean, he wasn't that popular leading up to this October 7th attacks. We know about the protests. Then right afterwards. But these hits in Lebanon and Iran and the one that's coming in Iran are definitely impressing people. And if they notice, Benny Gantz, Naftali Bennett, prime ministers, who are up and coming, maybe the next, they're all in support of hitting Iran. They're all in support of this Hezbollah operation. So they have a difference domestically.
Well, that is precisely the point about Iran, because they all see that Iran is the source of all the trouble, including on the West Bank, where it's funneling weapons in through Hamas and so the Palestinian Authority. So this idea that somehow you can separate Netanyahu from Israel, and you love Israel, but you hate Netanyahu, it doesn't work that way. This is a democracy. I mean, Netanyahu has a clear majority in the Knesset, the parliament. And for Biden and Harris and Obama and all of the others to basically say, well, we love the idea of Israel, we don't like its government, sorry, you don't get to choose. You are not a resident. You're not a citizen. You don't get to vote. But they have used American money to try to meddle in the Israeli elections. And so there's a kind of quality about their cooperation, which is strained and always begrudging and always with a kind of chip on their shoulder. And I think that has informed how Biden and Harris have acted. And of course, it's trickled down to the State Department. I mean, Blinken is just a fool on this issue. Jake Sullivan. I mean, remember how smart they thought they were? It was a real era of peace. What'd they say, that 5 days before October 7th? I mean, they have no idea. They have no idea of the venality of Iran. They keep trying to sugarcoat everything with Iran.
They just released $6 billion. They just released that $6 billion that was frozen in South Korea. That,
yes,
they said we'd approve it. It was in Qatar. They just got it. And remember, yes, Admiral Kirby said we would have to make sure it's put to the right thing. We'd have all these criteria on it. What did we do to stop it? Maybe we green-lighted it. So we give them $6 billion to defend against a would-be, a future Israeli attack, which is coming. Lastly, I want you to hear this. Cut two.
Does the U.S. have no sway over Prime Minister Netanyahu?
The aid that we have given Israel allowed Israel to defend itself against 200 ballistic missiles that were just meant to attack the Israelis and the people of Israel. And when we think about the threat that Hamas, Hezbollah presents, Iran, I think that it is without any question our imperative to do what we can to allow Israel to defend itself against those kinds of attacks.
We don't have any sway. By the way, since when did we tell them not to go into Lebanon?
Well,
I didn't even know that.
I'm sure we did. Their definition, Harris and Biden and Obama, their definition of Israel defending itself is essentially your border. You know, when they cross your border or when they send missiles across the border, then you can defend yourself. But what kind of, I mean, doesn't even in sports, you know, the offense gets the ball. You have to score. You have to stop these attacks. And so if it's just purely defense, then you are really tipping the game in favor of the enemy. We don't just play defense in America when it comes to attacks on our homeland or our citizens. We go and get the bad guys wherever they are. That's what Israel is doing. It's going to the source of the problem, not just playing whack-a-mole with the rockets that come over the border.
Lastly, there's a fear in New York that Cuomo's coming back. They're trying to mobilize Letitia James to stop him. I mean, number one, does she have any popularity at all? And number two is, would he be the best answer from what you know, as arrogant and self-important as he is?
I think Andrew Cuomo has some real political skills, and he's not afraid to upset anybody. The problem, I think, for him, Brian, is that he abused his power.
He did.
With the women and particularly on the issue of the nursing homes. He made a lot of mistakes.
100%.
And no remorse whatsoever. And that, to me, is going to kill his future in politics. I don't believe he can ever come back until he shows remorse. You cannot do what he did. He was forced to resign, or he would have been convicted, impeached and convicted by his own party. And he resigned to avoid that. But he has never owned up. He's still fighting all of the claims against him from the women and from the families who lost loved ones in the nursing homes. I think it's despicable. I think it's disqualifying. But I'm not sure that I can speak for all New Yorkers, because right now the city is in a real hole. I mean, the mayor's administration is melting away. Another deputy mayor resigned this morning. The whole administration is either under indictment or under investigation by the federal government. So there's something really rotten in this city hall. There are worse candidates in the wings. So this is a very difficult time for New York, and so I think that explains why there's any flicker of interest in having Andrew Cuomo run for mayor.
I don't know the details, but all I can tell you is that de Blasio, there's billions of dollars missing with the Thrive program. No one knows what this guy was up to for 8 years. And here is Adams in for 3 years, and they're trying to destroy him. I'm just wondering if politics is a play for some of this. Having said that, I want to bring you to this last topic. I thought that crowd in Butler was unbelievable. The size of the crowd, how motivated they were. Trump delivered a really good speech. Elon Musk was there. Here's what he said. Cut 12.
You know, the true test of someone's character is how they behave under fire. And we had one president who couldn't climb a flight of stairs, and another who was fist pumping after getting shot. Fight, fight, fight! Blood coming down the face. Now, America is the home of the brave.
And he gave some really good ad lib remarks, but he's the most significant guy in the world. Think about what he's done with Starlink. Think about what he's done with Tesla. Think about what he's done with SpaceX. Think about what he's doing with brain implants. And he says he's the Ben Franklin of our generation, or the Henry Ford, or the Thomas Edison. And he says, you know, the first time in politics, I'm going to support a Republican with my money and with my prestige. How significant is that?
I think it's very significant. And you know, the other thing, what he's doing is, you know, made Twitter the only free speech,
I forgot about Twitter,
you know, social media that we have. And which, of course, that's why Democrats hate them. They're not for free speech. That's dangerous. People say what they feel and what's on their minds. We can't have that. I think Elon Musk is an incredibly significant person, Brian. And I think one of the things that he brings to the Trump campaign is it broadens the idea of it. In some ways, RFK did. In some ways, Tulsi Gabbard does. In some ways, black voters do, and Latina voters. That Trump is more than just, you know, what Joe Biden would sneeze at as MAGA. I mean, it is a broadening coalition. And while Elon Musk is an extraordinary individual and brings a great reach, I think he is also a representative of what Trump is trying to do. Mm-hmm. As you and I have talked about, I still think Trump, you know, engages in too many petty feuds. I mean, the other day he called Liz Cheney, what did he call her, a stupid war hawk. Now, she is a war hawk, but she's not stupid. And I think the insults that get thrown in all the time like this really diminish the argument that he's trying to make to build a bigger tent. And I think that Elon Musk is reaching people that Trump himself didn't reach. I think the Kennedy people are people Trump wasn't reaching. We will see if he can grow this coalition to win this election. But I still think he needs to fix some of his language, which is a turnoff for some of the people he's trying to reach.
Yeah, women, suburban women. Michael Goodwin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
All right, listen, we got to take some calls on the other end. 1-866-408-7669. You can write me at briankilmeade.com. Just click on comments, and I'll get to them. It'll come right over to me. And keep in mind, too, we're looking at to see both the Democrats and Republicans are making different appearances today to commemorate October 7th. But who is going to make the difference? And when we get back, what David Axelrod said about hurricane victims, Republican hurricane victims, will astound you. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Remember his number, 32. Today we got 32 days until the election. So 32 days. 32 days. Okay, we got some business to do. We got some business to do. All right. 32 days, and we know we will do it.
So what do you think happened there? Turns out her prompter went down. That's the ability of the woman that wants to be the next president of the United States. Her prompter goes down, and she says 32 days 9 times. She has no idea why she's running. She has no idea what she does. And Selena Zito brought it up to me on Saturday night when I was on One Nation. She said, do you remember whatever you want to say about Sarah Palin? Do you remember her prompter went down on her acceptance speech at the RNC in Minnesota with all that pressure and all the drama and meeting her family? The woman nailed it. Didn't stop because she speaks. She's a governor. She was knows what it's like to do interviews, was on ESPN for a while. This is a woman who went to law school. You do nothing but present things in law school nonstop. AG, DA, sitting senator, you speak. That's all you do. People have said all you do is talk. You don't get stuff done. She cannot get off book. She cannot get off policy. That's why when Andrea Mitchell comes out and says there's a sense that she is lightweight. Business doesn't think she's real. Andrea Mitchell wants her to win in every way, shape, or form. But she can't see her winning the way things are right now unless she goes out and earns it. When your prompter goes down, when the prompter goes down for Trump, what do you think happens? Do you think he stops on a dime? You want to talk about bias. Listen to this. So North Carolina has become a battleground state, I think, even though Trump wins it slightly the last two elections. So you know that Western North Carolina has been devastated. David Axelrod insensitively, and I think wrongly, said this about how North Carolina would be affected. Listen to this. Can you imagine if Trump said this? Cut 14.
Those voters in Asheville are, they're the kind of voters who will figure out a way to vote. You know, they're upscale, kind of liberal voters. A bunch of these folks who've had their homes and lives destroyed elsewhere in Western North Carolina, in the mountains, there are going to be as easy to wrangle for the Trump campaign.
Okay, for one thing, his logic is: if you're really smart, you'll find a way to vote. If you're not smart, you'll never figure it out. If you want to know stereotypes, you want to go along with that, you're totally wrong. It's the people that work with their hands. They'd go to vocational schools. They'd have to work for a living and find a way. And they know if they don't get to work despite the weather, they're not going to get paid. Those are the ones who are built in resourcefulness. They don't need an Uber to show up. They don't need a driver to be there. They're used to depending on themselves. And if they want to vote, they get there. Number two is, I would never say that. Brian Kilmeade Show.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action now. If you're in the hurricane damage, it's certainly going to affect you. As we look at what today is, marking October 7th will certainly affect you. We're going to discuss all of that as well as talk about this campaign. And with me right now to discuss this is Dan Senor, former foreign policy advisor to the Bush administration, Mitt Romney, and author of The Genius of Israel, host of his great podcast called Call Me Back, Call Me Back with Dan Senor. Dan, welcome.
Hey, Brian, good to be with you.
I mean, just historic times. October 7th, where were you last year at this time?
I'd gone to bed. We had it was Shabbat. I had had Shabbat dinner, had celebrated a friend's birthday. I went to sleep late that night. Stupidly checked my phone before I went to sleep, and it was late at night, Friday night, October 6th, and given the time difference, I start to see in my WhatsApp groups and different chats Israeli family and friends starting to say that they were reports of violence. They were seeing violence coming across Israel's southern border with Gaza, and I thought, oh, this is just typical skirmishes that heat up between Hamas and Israel, like May of 21, like the summer of 22. And so I went to sleep, and the next morning I woke up, I checked again, and by then the reports were just jaw-dropping.
Right.
And I did something I never do. My sister, who lives in Israel, I have two sisters and a mother who live in Israel. My sister, one of my sisters, is a very observant Jew, and she keeps Shabbat. She observes the Sabbath, which means for the entirety of the time she has lived in Israel, she moved in 1994, she and I have never, ever spoken on the phone on a Sabbath or a Jewish holiday,
mm-hmm.
because I know she doesn't communicate on the phone on those holidays. And I thought to myself, you know what? Things seem pretty bad. I'm going to call her. And she answered. She has never in our entire adult lives answered the phone on a Shabbat.
I knew
it was bad. And then she proceeded to tell me what she was seeing. And it was worse than bad.
So, I mean, we're looking at what took place. Over 1,200 lose their lives. The attack happens on the 7th. By the 8th, Hezbollah is bombing in the north. And then Hamas attack lasts way too long, more than anyone thought. And then you guys end up coming back, or the IDF ember launches a ground invasion into Gaza after bombing it almost immediately. But the rockets never stopped, at which time people wonder how long this will last and how many hostages. According to reports, Hamas never thought they were going to get this many hostages, but they got hundreds of hostages. And I never thought
over 250.
Yeah, I never thought, too, a year later we'd be talking about still not knowing the location of 100.
Yeah, 101 still missing. The intel is getting worse on them, meaning from reports the intelligence is drying up. Four Americans still being held, that there's no verification of their life or no verification of their death. I think those four Americans should be household names in this country. I think our government should be doing everything every day to get them out. And at the same time, Brian, Israel is fighting a multi-front war. Hamas in Gaza is one of those fronts, but it's a multi-front war orchestrated by the head of the octopus, as Naftali Bennett said on my podcast, and that head of the octopus is in Tehran, the Islamic regime of Iran, which has an annihilation strategy against Israel, which is designed to squeeze Israel from every corner.
By 2040, right?
Yeah, by 2040. They have a clock in public display in Tehran that shows the countdown to the annihilation of Israel and the Jewish people. They tried on October 7th with the march up the south. Hezbollah was supposed to join as well so they could squeeze Israel from the south and the north. And Israel right now is trying to reestablish deterrence and remove some of those capabilities.
Dan, what do you say to people who say Hamas did this and surprised Hezbollah and Iran?
First of all, Hamas did this obviously trained by Iran, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, armed by Iran, funded by Iran. Whether or not Iran knew the specifics about when Hamas was going to do what, we just don't know. But we do know that waging a genocidal war against Israel was part of Iran's strategy, and to this day is a part of Iran's strategy.
I believe all three are on the same page, and I believe the initial Wall Street Journal report that said they had meetings in Beirut. I there's no doubt about it. I just think it's a joke when we quickly came out and said Iran seemed surprised by it, by our intelligence apparatus and our line of communication, because why else are you ready to bomb and strike on the day after to the degree in which Hezbollah did? So in terms of a year later, you know, we're also going to be witnessing today, if you told me, massive protests throughout, all organized throughout New York City and other cities. So how there could be protests, not against Hamas, but against Israel, is mind-boggling to me.
If you look at, imagine a year after Pearl Harbor, so December 7th, 1942. Imagine a year after 9/11, not September 11th, 2002. In neither of those cases would you ever imagine anything but just moments of reflection to remember those slaughtered? And instead, what you have today is people marching the streets of many cities in this country and on many college campuses showing solidarity with those who committed
the
atrocities.
Who's behind it?
We don't know. I genuinely don't know. I think it's a mix of foreign actors. And also, I got to tell you, Brian, this has unleashed real anti-Semitism that exists in this country. So we have this tendency to say, who's behind it? Was it this one, that one? It may just be that there's a reason why they call anti-Semitism the oldest hatred. It persists through century after century after century. And usually when the Jews get punched, when the Jews get hit hard, vilification of the Jews follows. That's a constant theme throughout anti-Semitism. October 7th, the massacre of the Jews occurred. October 8th, 30 student groups at Harvard University issued a statement blaming Israel, blaming the Jews. And from that moment forward, we saw the vilification campaign.
Right. And we also saw a huge pushback against those institutions. We know donations to Columbia is down 30%. They have the Students for Justice in Palestine. You got to be kidding me. This is a bunch of students. I mean, you can't get them to understand how complex this situation is. Since when do they care about the Palestinians? They have no interest in the Palestinians. But I get it that the professors bring it up and maybe they're unsympathetic to Israel. I get it. But to me, these people, there was nothing there. This seems to be choreographed and organized. I mean, they're rehearsing their chants.
Right.
Everything they must have a business account at Kinko's. The signs that they have up.
The tents. Yeah. The tents. Suddenly they all have $250 tents.
Where is
the exact same tents and the exact same design.
Yeah. Don't tell me. And get this. 4 in 10 Muslims say that they doubt that Hamas committed any murder and rape on October 7th. Four. Yeah. What do you say to people? And as I said to one
what
of the
I say to
families,
people is, look at what Hamas itself telegraphed. So with the Nazi atrocities, the Nazis went to great lengths to hide their atrocities. And the October 7th massacres, Hamas went to great lengths to telegraph its atrocities.
Yes.
So you don't have to take anyone's word for it but Hamas.
Let's just look at Kamala Harris and what she says on 60 Minutes. I guess it's going to air tonight. Here's what she said on whether Israel is an ally of the U.S. Cut one.
Do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
I think, with all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer to that question is yes.
Well, so basically she said, with all due respect, I'm going to change the question. Do we have an alliance between the American people and the Israeli people? And the answer is yes, not with Netanyahu. Where does this come from? I mean, she was a senator from California, probably never interacted with him at all. Next thing you know, she becomes vice president. Up until these attacks, you know, I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu was just a leader of an allied nation. And now she seems to have the same hatred that Barack Obama has for Netanyahu.
There were so many things that were alarming about what Vice President Harris said in that exchange that you just played. First of all, she gets bogged down this question about what she thinks of Netanyahu. The policy of Israel today, as it relates to Iran, as it relates to Hamas, is shared by the wide political spectrum in Israel, from right to left. Benny Gantz penned an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, for the New York Times a few days ago, in which he laid out why Israel must deal with Iran. So, or must confront Iran.
And
so
the supporter of the Hezbollah operation.
Right. So the idea that this is a Netanyahu-specific question is absurd. But more importantly, what she didn't say and what she should have said is, first of all, let me tell you why we, the United States, have an interest in holding Iran accountable. Iran has been supporting proxy groups that have been terrorizing international shipping, disrupting international trade through the Red Sea. Iran is building a nuclear weapon. Those are problems for the United States. Israel is confronting terrorist groups like Hezbollah. Hassan Nasrallah, I spoke to someone from CENTCOM last week, U.S. Central Command, who told me that Hassan Nasrallah is the third person most responsible for American bloodshed through terrorism. First was Osama bin Laden. Second was Qasem Soleimani, the former head of the IRGC in Iran. And the third was Hassan Nasrallah. So back in 1983, in April and October of 1983, Hassan Nasrallah, or Hezbollah at the time, he wasn't in charge at the time, but Hezbollah at the time was responsible for slaughtering hundreds of innocents, including Americans. How about thanking Israel for confronting the threats that continue to endure against Western civilization, including the United States?
So I want you to hear what David Bellavia told me Saturday night. As you know, we're a Medal of Honor recipient, fought in Iraq. Cut seven.
Israel has done in 11 months what our Congress and our Senate and our presidents would not allow our military to do, Brian, in 23 years. This is total war. You eliminate your enemies. And with all due respect to President Biden, we don't fight with proportionality when our citizens are being murdered.
Right. So what is the right proportion? And can you believe out of all the things that President Biden was commenting on, should they hit the nuclear facilities? It's not up to me to pick targets for other. No, I don't think so. Goes on to the oil fields. There might be better targets. We're talking about. What are you talking? Now you missed a conversation when it comes to tactics in the Middle East.
Right. Also, the idea that he would telegraph these things is so crazy. Jake Sullivan, White House National Security Advisor, last week after Iran hit Israel, said from the White House podium, there will be severe consequences for Iran, meaning severe consequences not just from Israel but from the United States. What does that mean? What are severe consequences against a country that is the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world and is building a nuclear weapon? How do you – what is proportional? When you're dealing with a country like that, a government like that, who is also trying to orchestrate a genocide against the Jewish people, what's proportional?
Right. So 15 days straight of bombing, 120 in Lebanon, 120 villages have been cleared out. They say to a degree, there's some reports coming out that the Lebanese people say, good, kill them all, because they've totally strangled their country.
Right.
They've taken over the political process, taken over the military process, and now they're exporting their terror to Africa, to Syria. Syrians hate them.
Right.
Because they were loyal to Assad, burying people alive.
Hundreds of thousands of Syrian Sunni Muslims are dead today because of Hezbollah. I've been struck, Brian, since Israel, beginning with the pager attack, and then obviously Israel taking out a lot of the rocket and missile infrastructure of Iran, of Hezbollah's, and then taking out Nasrallah. I've been struck by the number of officials and regular citizens in Sunni Arab countries who have messaged me saying what Israel is doing is important. They need to keep it up. They weren't saying that when Israel was confronting Hamas, which is one thing. But it bears noting that when it comes to Hezbollah, they're completely supportive for a variety of reasons, right. Not the least of which is Hezbollah is a wrecking ball in the region, and Hezbollah's been responsible for so much bloodshed in Syria.
And Hamas is Sunni, and Hezbollah is Shia.
Right.
And normally Iran would have an alliance with Hamas, but not as close as Hezbollah.
Right.
They've gotten really close since Sinwar, and Sinwar being named the leader, he reached out right away to Iran. So that's going to increase things. So lastly, Dan, what is the situation in Gaza now? We hear one battalion left out of all of it, but still rockets are coming into Israel. What is the state of the game in Gaza militarily?
I think Israel has done a good job. It took too long, and that was for a variety of reasons. It took too long. Some of it was some indecision on Israel's part. Some of this also was restraint forced
Don't go
on
into
Israel
Rafah.
by the Biden administration, which was a mistake because Israel lost about 3 months when it was contemplating whether or not to go into Rafah. Israel always said, I know you're concerned. I know, America, you're concerned about these 1 million Palestinian civilians in southern Israel. We can move them. The United States says you can't move them. Remember, Kamala Harris says, I've looked at the maps. Israel can't move them.
She looked at the
maps. She's a map expert. And Israel, when they finally decided to do it, moved over 1 million people in 10 days. So Israel was just fine moving. And they could have done it 3 months earlier. So they lost a lot of time. That said, Israel has broken most of the Hamas military infrastructure. Keep in mind, Hamas is organized like a light infantry army of a sovereign nation. It's got 24 to 26 battalions. These battalions are assigned to geographies. They have a real command and control, a real chain of command structure. Israel has decimated most of that. It doesn't mean that there are still fighters from within those battalions who are surviving more like lone wolves. But the whole organization of Hamas as a military is basically broken. Israel now has to decide what's going to be in Gaza going forward. And it needs some cooperation from the Arab world. It needs some moderate Palestinians to step forward. It would help a lot if Israel got Sinwar. They haven't been able to yet, meaning many Palestinians live in fear of Sinwar. Sinwar was serving 4 life sentences in an Israeli prison when he was released in 2011, not because of those sentences were not doled out, meted out based on what he'd done to Jews, to Israelis, based on what he'd done to Palestinians. He was infamous for being the architect of retribution against Palestinians who were, quote unquote, collaborating with the Israelis. So Palestinians are terrified of Sinwar. If Israel gets Sinwar, I think it'll be easier for Palestinians to step forward.
Yeah, and also he was let go in a prisoner swap.
Yeah.
That's the worry.
Yeah.
You want all the hostages out, but if you get another 1,000 terrorists, what about the next crop of hostages? Aren't they important too?
Yeah.
Because it's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
A tough situation, but Israel's handling it as great as possible. And I cannot wait to see their attack on Iran and the type of toll it takes on that terror nation. Dan Senor, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Good luck with your podcast. Call me back with Dan Senor. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm feeling great. And I'm feeling nervous. You know, there's this old adage, there are only 2 ways to run. Without an opponent or scared. So there you go. I think you and your listeners have really got this thing right, which is one of the best ways to communicate with people is to be real.
Right. And she is so real. Whatever that is. I'm not sure anyone could imitate that. In fact, even Saturday Night Live sounds more succinct and cogent and coherent than she does in real life. I think she's had a terrible few weeks. And then when you see these reports in Politico that Democratic, they talk to about a dozen Democratic operatives who say that she is essentially has too light of a schedule, has way too many meetings, not enough appearances, doesn't seem sure of herself. And now people like Andrea Mitchell and others say she's got to go out and do interviews. This is Trump's best scenario. I said this. When the momentum stops and the DNC is over, when you come out of this and Labor Day is in our rearview mirror as a country, that's when you have to start doing well in the polls. It'll do two things. Number one, it'll surge your support because it'll show you can win. And number two, it'll make her come out and compete for it. Is it okay? The New York Times endorsed her, and I'll just paraphrase what they said. It is not a good precedent to go become president of the United States without knowing your policies, having tried out those policies, having tested them on the debate stage with people in your own party, let alone let the people of your country know what you would do if you got the job. Even though they prefer her, they don't like the way she got it. And I think a lot of undecided independents who look at her and have no idea what she'll do, look at the Trump policy and say, I like them.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Now, the work that we do diplomatically with the leadership of Israel is an ongoing pursuit around making clear our principles, which include the need for humanitarian aid, the need for this war to end, the need for a deal to be done which would release the hostages and create a ceasefire. And we're not going to stop in terms of putting that pressure on Israel and in the region, including Arab leaders.
So that is some of the interview that Kamala Harris has recorded already with 60 Minutes and will be out. I'm sure if it was something even bigger than that, we would have known about it already, although I'm not positive. There would have been some leaks about how it went off the rails. But she did do an interview with 60 Minutes. Donald Trump turned it down, at which time she made it clear she's allied with the Israeli people, but not with the government. I also thought you could say, I'm allied with the Iranian people, just not the government. Would you put them in the same breath? She would. I have no idea where President Obama, before he even got the job, just disliked Bibi Netanyahu. And she has picked that up. Ariel Lightstone joins us now. He served as senior advisor to Ambassador David Friedman for 4 years. Ariel, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian. Nice to see you.
So what do you take from that statement?
It's on par. It's on brand. She has an inability to say we stand with Israel. She has an inability to say that we stand with the democratically elected leadership of Israel. It's a stated goal of the Harris-Biden administration to bring down the Bibi government. How do you possibly speak this way about an ally in the middle of a war for their very survival?
So she feels that way. Do you think that affects Netanyahu's policies?
Yeah, by the way, I think it affects Netanyahu's policies meaningfully. If you remember, Israel has been playing defense from October 7th all the way up to Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit to America end of July. He met with Biden, he met with Harris, he met with Trump. And there was something that he learned from all three of those meetings that said, I can't play defense anymore. I got to play offense. And my guess is much more what he heard from Vice President Harris than he heard from anybody else that, oh, my God, if she winds up winning, Israel will truly be alone. I got to go on offense now.
Yeah, I mean, and Tim Walz is not better. When you look at things happening right now, you have a lot of anti-Semitic, anti-Israel protests going on in New York City and other major city, all organized, all financed. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, I'm just looking at the list. It goes on all day in every major, in Herald Square, in Union Square, up by Columbia, up by Rockefeller Plaza. They're everywhere. Where are these people coming from?
Well, where are these people coming from is a fascinating question. The fact that they share our subway system and go to our universities, probably paid for with your and my taxpayer dollars. Let's just be very clear. I've spent today, unfortunately, going from memorial ceremony to memorial ceremony, listening to eulogy after eulogy. These people are not protesting in favor of two-state solution. They're not protesting in favor of Palestinian rights. They're out there protesting, or in the case of many, rioting on behalf of Hamas, a terror organization who murdered, pillaged, raped, and still holds hostage over 100 people, including four Americans. And the fact that nobody stands up in the New York City system or in the New York State system and condemns these people is outrageous.
There's been 1,200 anti-Semitic incidents on U.S. college campuses, a 500% increase from the year prior. This after you would think people would unite around them. and the protests are going on all day. So I just hope that people realize not everybody feels like that. I think that one thing is abundantly clear, even though you want to look back on that day and how it happened, and I'm sure there's going to be an analysis of how they misunderstood what Hamas was capable of. But since that time, the gains in Lebanon over the last 15 days, could you put that in perspective? They've basically decapitated the Hezbollah higher-ups. They've taken out at least the top 8, maybe the top 30, most of them, including the one who was supposed to take over for Nasrallah. And now at least 3,000 got hurt in the pager explosions. Where are you at right now?
It's movie season. The new movies are coming out right now. If you were to sell this plot to any Hollywood writer, they would tell you it's too fanciful and not possible. Israel has its mojo back, and Hezbollah is on the run. The right response by all of the allies, led by the United States of America, is don't step on the gas, slam on the gas. And instead, we hear from Macron and from the Brits, and unfortunately from Biden and Harris, is step on the brakes. When your enemy is retreating, get them. And Israel is getting them. Unfortunately, they're getting them on their own.
What should the strike back in Iran after 180 rockets hit Israel? Where would you like to see them target?
I don't know if you can say everywhere, but if you have to be specific in your targets, look, their oil infrastructure has funded all of this, and their nuclear infrastructure is the fear of tomorrow. How can they cripple both of those? If they can, they should. And President Trump recommended that.
So are they capable of doing damage to the nuclear program without our help?
The answer is yes, but perhaps not overtly. Certainly they've been doing this covertly. Let's just paint the picture for all the listeners. They were able to take out the leader of Hamas, who was staying in the equivalent of the Blair House, as though he was visiting the White House, the Iranian version of that, the most protected guest house in all of Iran. And they're able to take just him and the bodyguard out in the middle of the night. If Israel's capable of doing that, the beeper episode, the taking out of Nasrallah in the bunker, the Iranians don't know where Israel will hit them next. The challenges, and here's the question that every Democrat should be asked. When they signed on to the Iran deal, the commitment from Iran is they only want to use nuclear for peaceful uses. If it's for peaceful uses, why is it being built underneath a mountain? Why are all of these things there? And why aren't we holding the Democrats who signed on to this to account?
Yeah, you have 250 Hezbollah terrorists have been killed. That was their bodyguard. Hamas was their other bodyguard. The Houthi rebels who got bombed by the UK and US a couple of days ago, and Israel has lit them up too. Hopefully we'll start doing some damage there. I don't know how they're still doing it, but I just think that this attack should probably take place. The longer you wait, the more restrictions will come on. I imagine that's going to take place this week. And are they capable of knocking down 180 rockets?
Is Iran capable of knocking down 180 rockets? Most certainly not.
Right.
Iran won't know what hits them when Israel attacks. And I'll disagree only slightly. You know, Iran has had the Israeli people waiting for 364 days for what might happen next. It won't hurt the Iranian people to not know when they go to sleep at night, whether they get hit tonight or tomorrow night or maybe in 8 nights from now. Living in that little bit of fear is actually, I think, pretty good for them.
So what I thought was Naftali Bennett, somebody who could be prime minister, he is very much for a big hit. He has not been critical at all of the Hezbollah operation. You know the politics in Israel better than I will ever know. But Benny Gantz doesn't seem critical of this operation at all. Are people mischaracterizing what Netanyahu, type of support Netanyahu has in Israel?
Completely and totally. The Biden-Harris administration has tried to make this Bibi's war because Bibi is some bugaboo world. Like when people say Trump, they've got this derangement syndrome. There is unanimity in Israel. It's got to be 95% approval to get rid of the threat of Hezbollah so people can go back to their homes in the north. And so Israel can go to sleep safely at night, not terrified of rockets.
Yeah, that would be interesting to have that happen, have them on their heels. But then there would be retaliation. Do you think the Grand Ayatollah has a reason to fear for his welfare?
As well, he should. Yeah, he talks a big game, barks a big bite. But there is no doubt that when he goes to pick up the phone, every time he picks up the phone, he's got to be second-guessing the intelligence of making that decision. Israel has them on the run.
Macron has come out critical of Israel, calling for an arms embargo, slowing down of weapons. Where does that come from?
It comes from a base that he has within France. Like, people criticize Harris because of the Michigan vote. There's a meaningful base within France that is radical political Islam that wants him to stand against Israel. Now, here's the advantage. France doesn't send weapons to Israel, and Israel wouldn't use them even if they had them. So this is a political statement that's completely and totally ineffective, but it's used just to be able to try to separate again Israel from its ally, France. It's pretty embarrassing, Frank.
It is, but it is kind of scary if you're Netanyahu, who rebuked, because you'd say, where are these supposed to be my allies? How could you not see what Hezbollah has done to the Middle East? How could you not see what Hamas has done? How could you not remember how close the Abraham Accords are?
My basement. I'm sorry. We currently have a siren. We're going down to the shelter. Sorry, Brian.
Oh, I wasn't fully aware you were in Israel. Okay.
Yeah, I'm in Israel, and we're bringing the family down to the bunker. You get to.
Are you carrying your own camera?
I got my own computer here.
Okay. I wouldn't even ask you.
We got the family here.
And you guys, I see your family in the background. You guys are used to this. This is a secure shelter. Yeah, we might have lost them. You know, when stuff like this happens, you hit, you miss. So you lose it and you come back. Just like with your phone, you hit an area and you hit the area. It's a dead spot. And then all of a sudden the area comes back. So I'll be open to that. But he's heading down to the basement because he hears the sirens. So that's how real it is. Ari Lightstone could stay here. Well, it's relatively calm, but he says, I'm going to Israel. It's anything but calm. That is pretty, it's pretty insightful and enlightening about how serious it is in Israel. But they're on the front foot. All right, you're listening to Brian Kilmeade Show. We're going to take a timeout and come back with your calls and your emails, and we might find out if there's more to know. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Now let's say hello and then goodbye for the next 4 years to our vice presidential candidates, J.D. Vance and Tim Walz.
It's a good handshake. I like this guy.
Gentlemen, welcome to the debate. Mr. Vance, please give your opening statement.
Thank you for having me. I want to begin with something that will appeal to women voters. I understand that both moderators tonight are mothers, and I like that.
Okay. And Governor Walz, it looks like you're already scribbling a bunch of notes. Are you preparing your answers?
Nah, I got to grade these papers. Got to stack midterms. I don't know the answer, so I'm going to just say the word fundamental a bunch. Because debating is 30% fun and 70% demental. How am I doing?
Yeah, I thought the Walz character was good. I thought he was good. I was amazed how they made Kamala Harris seem like this great stateswoman. Here's a little more.
Okay. He's out there. He's doing his thing, whatever that may be.
Come on, just relax. You know, you haven't had a night off in 3 months. Do you want to watch something less stressful like the Menendez Brothers show?
I don't know, Dougie. I kind of wish I had picked Josh right now.
Oh, Josh Shapiro?
No, Josh. Cabernet.
Look, Tim will be fine. It's not like he's going to say something crazy.
I've become friends with school shooters.
Okay, little flub there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know what the whole Doug thing. I don't even know how you imitate him. He's such a bland character. But I thought that was relatively funny. I just don't. I think that they just let her avoid the word salad, all her thing about not knowing anything. It's like they used to have fun saying Al Gore was stiff and George Bush was dumb. And they used to go to town with it, and the guys used to have fun with it because he was insulting everyone. That Barack Obama was having an easy time, and Hillary Clinton was getting the hardest questions. They had fun with it. Let's find out if there's more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Hey, the San Jose State team, I don't know if you're following this or not, but this is the latest salvo in the ridiculousness of letting men pretend to be women and then destroy women's sports. Now at the college level, San Jose State's women's volleyball team refused to play against another team, Coastal Carolina, because they had a transgender athlete. Brooks Slusher, the co-captain, was one of the people who voted not to play. Listen to Brooke.
I think anyone that does play volleyball understands that women and men have a very big strength difference. So when you're sitting there swinging against a man, the strength and power behind that ball is just so much different than it is behind any woman that I've ever seen in my life. So it's just the fear of you don't know what to expect. You don't know how to dodge it fast enough. There's just so many things running through people's minds.
So San Jose State, they're in the middle of this. The controversy surrounding San Jose State's women's volleyball team getting more complicated. The teams continue to forfeit matches amid reports the Spartans have a redshirt senior, Blair Fleming, transgender. Fleming played the previous two seasons with San Jose State, 1 year for Coastal Carolina, in virtual anonymity. But this began to be controversial when Southern Utah forfeited its match against San Jose State in the Santa Clara tournament. That sparked a series of forfeits from other schools, Boise State, Wyoming, and Utah State. It further became public that Fleming's teammates, roommate, and team co-captain Brooke Slusher joined several other female athletes in a lawsuit suing the NCAA for violations of Title IX. The NCAA said it will continue to promote Title IX, making unprecedented investments in women's sports and ensure fair competition. How could that possibly be fair? Next, homeschooling rates reportedly surge across the country in the wake of COVID. Hopkins University Institute for Education Policy said that its analysis shows that homeschooling rate for 21 states this academic year, noted that only 30 states keep track of their homeschoolings, but among the 21 states that do, said only two showed a decline. The other 19 showed sharp increases, Georgia 2%, Delaware much higher at 29%. Quote, the union showed that their true colors and pushed more families to embrace homeschooling long term. Families saw the leftist indoctrination happening in public schools through remote learning, and many of them became more confident in their ability to homeschool. I think that's a good job. More pressure. And if all of a sudden the schools start having less and less kids, they're going to be forced to change. That's one way to do it. Next, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg surpassed Jeff Bezos as the world's second richest man. His net worth, $206 billion, according to Bloomberg Billionaires Group. He's topping $205 billion, as I mentioned. The net worth of CEO Mark Bezos, $205, Zuckerberg's $206. With his 13% stake in Meta, Zuckerberg's net worth has risen by $78 billion since the beginning of the year, which is more than any other member of the 500 richest. See, I don't get it, because nobody I know is joining Facebook. It's become an older platform. I don't get it. Zuckerberg's rise to the second spot in the index on Thursday underscores how his personal wealth has grown alongside investor enthusiasm for the social media giant. I guess Instagram is growing, and they want to make Facebook a little younger. They're trying to get younger, but I don't know. I mean, that really surprises me. So it goes Elon Musk, number one, Zuckerberg, number two, Bezos, three, Ellison, five, Gates, six, Larry Page, seven, Warren Buffett, eight, Steve Ballmer, nine, and Sergey Brin is 10. And next, one in five say fresh coffee is better than having sex. Over half Americans claim a good cup of coffee can be so powerful it can turn their worst days into good ones. One in five say it is better than sex. They did a survey of 2,000 American coffee drinkers. Now, I'm wondering who sponsored this. This was commissioned by La Columba and Chobani, and conducted by Talker Research. La Columba, is that a coffee?
I'm just curious about where you fall on this, because you're a big fan of certain coffees, like his pumpkin spice latte. Does that make you agree with something like this?
Here's what I feel. I feel if you brew the coffee and just don't pour syrup in, it's a new ballgame. The syrup I find to be a big turnoff. More on that later. I'll talk about this in Peekskill, New York, October 20th at 7 o'clock. It's a Sunday.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I have one big show coming your way in a big hour. We have Carl Rove standing by, Tim Kennedy in the eye of the storm, in the aftermath of the storm in North Carolina. He's doing some incredible work with Save Our Allies, Saving Our Americans. He's a former UFC star and a special operator. He's as great as it gets. Him and 19 veterans have been doing fantastic work, just like they were doing in Afghanistan. And they were hindered really by FEMA and the government and how slow they were to move and to be able to get helicopters to get to people who were victims of landslides and flooding that nobody was expecting or was not expecting, they were not prepared for. We'll take your calls, too, in between, at 1-866-408-7669. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
At the federal level, this has been a massive failure. And you could just ask the people there on the ground. I have been there. I was in Georgia. I was in Florida, where Hurricane Helene made landfall. FEMA has lost sight of its core mission, I think, in so many cases.
Yeah, in many cases, and they're getting a pass. Hurricane Helene's power is still being evaluated, and the damage across seven states and the needs for thousands are not being met in many cases anyway. Why did it take the Army so long to get summoned to come in? They could fix this and could have fixed it quickly. The media mysteriously has few questions. I do.
Number two.
Just 28% of Americans think the U.S. is on the right track, and I want you to put that into perspective, right? When does the average, when the incumbent party loses the election, look at that. It's just 25%. This, to me, is a bad sign for Kamala Harris's campaign.
2024, 29 days away, and the risk-averse Harris is hearing it from her side. Trump pulls off the rally of his run so far to date with a mammoth crowd in Butler, a good theme with Elon Musk as a special guest. We look at the polls and game plans with Carl.
Number one.
Do we have a real close ally in Prime Minister Netanyahu?
With all due respect, the better question is, do we have an important alliance between the American people and the Israeli people?
I did not
know. And
the
answer to that question is yes.
I did not know you could reshape questions. This is new to me. October 7th attacks in Israel 1 year later. Everything has changed, and what infuriates me is the protest planned against Israel in New York City and around the country. Kamala Harris made clear she does not like Bibi but likes Israeli people, I guess. Why I believe Israel has to continue to escalate in order to de-escalate. Carl Rove joins us now, former deputy chief of staff to best-selling author, senior advisor to George W. Bush, knows all about natural disasters. They say, Carl, this is the second most costly one, most damaging one since Katrina. Have you seen the stats? Do you concur?
It sounds like it. I mean, it is just anecdotal, but I've got friends in Western North Carolina and Northern South Carolina, and boy, the damage is just jaw-dropping. And it's going to be expensive. I mean, the federal government just authorized a $100 million emergency grant to the North Carolina Department of Transportation to help them with reopening roads and really replacing roads in the mountainous regions of the western part of the state.
Pretty significant. So I've been talking to people at Fort Bragg, Fort Liberty now, and they were waiting for the call for a week. They said they could have been fully loaded, ready to go last Monday, a week ago yesterday, but they weren't called. Can you bring me inside the decision-making process because you were there with Bush?
Yeah, look, first of all, there's a misunderstanding about this. In 1968, the Congress passed the Stafford Act, named after its sponsor, a U.S. senator from Vermont. And the Stafford Act set up our modern federal emergency management agency and the procedures. FEMA is check riders and suppliers. So the principal responsibility lies with the state. The state has to, in essence, ask for a declaration, which was immediately granted, and they then need to say, this is what we need. You don't want the federal government trying to decide what ought to happen in Florida. You want the Florida governor to say, this is what I need, and put him in charge. He can call up the National Guard. He's got the people on the ground. The federal presence in this kind of thing is relatively small in any given state. And so the Stafford Act said wisely, this is going to be left up to the states, and the federal government is to provide resources upon request, and it's to provide the money to pay for these things. So I don't know whether Governor Cooper, the governor of North Carolina, said, I need helicopters to bring people in. But it's his state emergency management director who's responsible for saying, I need help, and this is the help I need, and here's where I need it. So I don't know what where the gap was, but generally I've found that if a state emergency management person asks for something, they get it and they get it quickly, particularly if A, it's from the military, and B, if it's from a military installation in the affected state.
So if you're sitting there and you're president and you see that things are moving slowly and these people are falling off mountains or disappearing and there's no communication, could you say, hey, Governor Cooper, you're my buddy. You're going to need some help here.
Yeah. Yes. Look, I remember painfully from the Katrina experience. That's what we spent a large amount of time telling the, you know, telling the governor of Louisiana and the mayor of New Orleans, we're here. What do you need? In fact, we ended up having to send down a specific person to sort of basically embed himself, you know, General Honore, in the state FEMA office, the emergency management people, because it was clear they didn't know what the heck they were doing. But it is up to, under the federal law, it is the principal responsibility is maintained at the state and local level, and the state can say it's beyond our capacity to handle. This happened, I believe, after the Northridge earthquake in the 1990s. Governor Pete Wilson said, I need federal intervention. It happened in several other natural disasters. We tried to get Louisiana to allow us to federalize the event. You remember how bad we had looters in New Orleans, and everything spiraled out of control. Well, we said, look, we have units of the 82nd Airborne and the 101st that could be here in a matter of hours to restore public safety in the parish of New Orleans and surrounding parishes, and we couldn't get the governor to agree. And there's only two ways to make this happen. You either have to have the governor invite you in, or you have to invoke the Insurrection Act, which, has specific things that it has to test to meet. Eventually, we solved the problem by sending in the 82nd and the 101st, but grabbing people with a federal badge, the General Services Administration people and national park rangers, blah, blah, DEA agents, anybody with a badge, so that these units of roving military would have somebody who had the authority to say, you're under arrest, and cuff them. Otherwise, it would have been illegal.
Okay.
But it's a complicated process in many ways, but it's simple in another. The governor is in charge, and we tried in 2006 to change the law to put the federal government in charge, and it was opposed by the nation's governors, including, interestingly enough, the governor of the state of Florida, the brother of the president of the United States, said, no way do I want the federal government to be in charge of disaster relief in Florida. I want to be in charge as the governor.
Here's what Senator Tom Tillis in North Carolina said. Cut 32.
We've got to clear roads. Most roads you still have to assume are closed in western North Carolina. I've been out there twice this week. I'll be out there every day last week, every day this week. But just the basics of debris removal, rescue operations, things that the Department of Defense, the 82nd Airborne, the 101st are accustomed to doing in battle situations are exactly what we need in western North Carolina.
So go ahead.
He's right. So Governor Cooper, get to listen to your state senior senator and ask the federal government for exactly that kind of assistance.
So let's move on to 2024. David Axelrod, I thought, I was kind of like listening, and I think both sides listen to you, Republicans, Democrats, and Axelrod, because, you'll criticize your own side. And this, I think he was tone deaf. He talked about North Carolina and the devastation there and who's going to pay the price electorally. Cut 14.
Those voters in Asheville are they're the kind of voters who will figure out a way to vote. You know, they're upscale kind of liberal voters. A bunch of these folks who've had their homes and lives destroyed elsewhere in western North Carolina in the mountains there are going to be as easy to wrangle for the Trump campaigns.
Your thoughts?
First of all, I'm not certain that David is right that Asheville, look, he's a friend of mine. I don't want to be offensive, but just because they're liberals don't mean that they know how to vote better than conservatives. But the other thing is that I bet you there are a lot of people in Buncombe County, the home of Asheville, and in Boone County, and the only other blue county, I think, in the district, that are suffering the same as people elsewhere in the district, and that is their homes have been destroyed and they're someplace else. I mean, I'm a friend of mine, one of my office mates in Austin, her brother, who lives west of Asheville, he's in Atlanta now and not expecting to be able to return home before Election Day. you know, how this all plays out, you know, the problem is that there are three counties in far western North Carolina and five counties in northern Georgia that have been devastated by this. And a lot of people are going to find themselves in a place where they're not going to be where they normally yeah. are to vote when the election rolls around. And that's going to fall with more more effect on Republicans, simply because there are a lot more Republicans in those regions than there are Democrats. And maybe David is right that the people in Asheville will find a way, come heck or high water, to vote, but I'm not certain of it. I mean, this is going to have an electoral impact, and I think adversely more on Republicans than Democrats, but not because Democrats are smarter at voting. It's because the Republicans, there are more Republicans in these regions of the two states, and a lot of them have lost their homes and their livelihoods, and their communities are devastated.
So Politico has a different report. They said on Saturday, based on interviews with two dozen Democratic operatives, they want to be anonymous. They are criticizing the Harris campaign as too light, too scripted, and interactions are too risk adverse. And they see how close it is in the polls, and they knocked her for relatively a light campaign schedule. Are those criticisms valid from your perspective?
Yeah, I think so. Now, I think the other thing is, though, that these criticisms have been out there for a while, and I think the Harris-Walz campaign is responding. I mean, you know, at the last minute, Walz is on Fox News Sunday, and she's doing 60 Minutes, and she does this gigantic podcast that has 50 million mostly women listeners. I mean, it's, you know, they're responding to it, and but she tried to sort of duplicate the Biden strategy of low visibility and local interviews, but we live in a different world, and people are going to have to get on these podcasts and get on the TikTok and get on Instagram and get on Facebook and do things that garner the viewers there, because particularly the people who are up for grabs in this election are more likely to be digitally oriented than they are the traditional, you know, legacy media.
Here's what Andrea Mitchell said, Cut 15.
They've got to double down on doing more interviews and serious interviews, because what I'm hearing from Democratic and Republican business people and a lot of men, and she's got such a big problem with men. I think there's an undercount of the Trump vote. I think there is misogynation in all of this, black and white men. Big problem, but also the business world. They don't think she is serious. They don't think she's a heavyweight. And a lot of this is gender. But she's got to be more specific about her economic plans.
So for her to bring that, you know, she wants to, with all her power, Trump not to win. But that's what she's hearing. Unserious. You know where her husband is, Alan Greenspan. Yeah. So that's who they know.
Right. Yeah. Well, two things. One is, I think she's right that it needs to be more substantive. Both sides need to be more substantive. The people who are more substantive with a second act are going to have a leg up on Election Day, because the American people sort of know both of these people, him more than her. But the thing that they don't know about either one of them is we've not gone through the normal process that would allow each one of them to sculpt the second term agenda in a way that people get their hands around. And particularly here at the end, when the sort of the undecided voters and the low propensity voters are finally paying attention, they need to be doing that. But here's the other part. With all due respect to Andrea Mitchell, she represents the legacy media. So what she was really saying that was, my network needs to have more interviews with her, and she needs to go on, you know, Meet the Press and Face the Nation and, you know, blah, 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 the legacy media. And Donald Trump has demonstrated in his campaigns that you can go around the legacy media. And she, I think, is starting to do that. But this is a lot of this is she's not going to be doing the right thing until she comes on my network and does an interview with me.
Could be, but it's just so pervasive. I've never seen anything like it.
Oh yeah,
I mean, I want
yes, we have. We saw this four years ago when Joe Biden was hanging out in the basement. But as I say, I think this flurry in the last couple of days, we'll see if it continues or if it's just one episode. But I think whoever these people are on the Democratic side who said you need to step it up have been heard. And, you know, my suspicion is the Trump campaign would hope that they hadn't heard. But, you know, it was smart for Walz to go on Fox News Sunday, you know, and it was smart for her to do the 60 Minutes interview.
Let's see. And let's hear it first.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Here's the deal. You're right. Performance matters.
But it would be worse for her if she didn't go on and do these things, because people would then say she's trying to hide something, as opposed to go on and, you know, see if she can put two sentences together and avoid word salad.
Al Smith dinner, she's missing that, and the people
big
are still
mistake, big mistake, big yeah. mistake.
Because I'll be there.
And
that's one of the reasons.
I don't understand why.
Right.
Yeah.
It would have been on the prompter. Someone else would have written it. Nobody holds you to a high comedy standards. You don't have to be Don Rickles at a Dean Martin roast. Lastly, just real quick, under a minute, Michigan won by 1 point for Harris. Wisconsin, 2 points for Harris. Pennsylvania, dead heat. What does that look for? What do you think that means?
Well, it means it's going to be a very close election, and it's up for grabs. If she takes those three states, she's likely to be the president. If she loses Pennsylvania, she's not likely to be president. And, you know, if you look at it, I every morning I get up and look at the Real Clear Politics average, the 538 average, the aggregates for those states, yeah, and the silver bulletin. And if you look at it today, two of the three aggregators say she's at 276 and he is at 252. And Real Clear Politics says with Pennsylvania being a tie in it, that those 19 are set aside and neither one of them has 270, and he's ahead at 252.
Amazing. Carl Rove, thanks so much. Always great.
Thank you, sir. All the best.
All right. 1-866-408-7669. Tim Kennedy brings us inside Helena in just a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. I went a little long with Carl Rove, but I could talk to him for 2 hours and still leave a lot on the table. And what I love about guys like that and women like this, when you don't need any cheerleaders. I'm just not interested in it. You might be out there and saying, you know, I want Trump to win, or I want Harris to win, or I want Tim Shee to win over Montana, whatever it is. But if you actually want to know the chance of winning, what good is it to just point out someone's pluses and say they're going to win? There's no doubt about it. Well, there's always doubt, number one. Number two is you got to go to the voters. It's not, you're not making the decision, especially if you're in, like me, in New York. I'm definitely not picking the president. But it doesn't mean I'm not going to vote in other elections and feel as though I'm going to have an impact there. But if you're in Pennsylvania and you're one of the undecideds, he knows how to get inside those people's head and find out what they're thinking and where the campaign is working. By the way, he knows people all over the Trump campaign and where it isn't. Tim Kennedy next.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Let's talk about some of the misinformation that is out there, including these claims from former President Trump that FEMA is about $1 billion short because money has been going to undocumented immigrants. Also, that the Republican areas of the state are being intentionally ignored in some fashion.
You know, it's frankly ridiculous and just plain false. This kind of rhetoric is not helpful to people. You know, it's really a shame that we're putting politics ahead of helping people, and that's what we're here to do. We've had the complete support of the state. We've had the local officials helping to push back on this dangerous, truly dangerous narrative that is creating this fear of trying to reach out and help us or to register for help.
So that is the head of FEMA pushing back on people that say that things aren't going well, that people aren't getting the aid they need. That is disinformation, because she doesn't feel that way. Well, what about the people that don't feel like they're getting the aid they need? Are they lying? Tim Kennedy joins us now. He's been on the ground. He's co-founded Save Our Allies. You know him, MAA fighter, special operator. He's been on the ground trying to help out the best he can. Tim, what is the situation? I think you were mostly in North Carolina, right?
That's correct, Brian.
So,
yeah,
So go ahead. Do you want to comment on what the head of FEMA said?
I mean, I first want to praise the men and women that are on the ground. You know, the 82nd Airborne and the 101st, they arrived, the military and the Army specifically, led by Sergeant Major of the Army, Mike Weimer, and General George and General Donahue. I mean, they're bending over backwards that, you know, they put, in essence, careers on the line to try to get the right people on the ground. And now, you know, like we have the 82nd and 101st. And even the people from federal organizations like FEMA that are on the ground doing the work, they're working really hard. The problem is that the goals sometimes are not aligned. We're trying to get up into the mountains. We're trying to find the people that are the most seriously, holding on by a thread. And the situation is so devastating and dire there that, like, a day might make the difference between life and death. Big bureaucratic machines, they move very slowly, and their priorities are not always aligned with the people that are on the ground trying to do the work.
Are they coordinated? So you show up with your group. They want to know where you're going. You can't just go on your own. How does it coordinate?
Yeah, that was the biggest. That was by far the largest cluster, was the C2, the command and control element. So there's this thing called ICS, the Incident Command System. And, you know, this is supposed to be rehearsed. This is supposed to be practiced. You know, the governor has certain authorities. He can use the National Guard, and he appoints specific people that are going to be running depending on the severity of the disaster. For a disaster of this magnitude, it's like every lever gets pulled, every red button gets pushed, and that just never happened. So what should have happened was, at the highest level, governor should have said, okay, we're mobilizing Title 32, North Carolina National Guard is coming in, and they're going to try and save lives. Concurrent to that, federal agencies like FEMA, and we're going to be participating and coordinating with the Red Cross and Samaritan's Purse and Save Our Allies, our organization. That never happened. It was an absolute disaster, and to such a degree, like, they're coming in, they're trying to find hotel rooms. I was even told that I was a liar because I went on Fox, and I spoke specifically of a night I had just done. It was like 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, a health and wellness check of an infant child and their parents. I go to check on some hotels to see if I can find a place to stick them, and I go hotel after hotel. They're powered. They have no way to receive any people to stay there, and I find a hotel that has power. And I drive up the driveway, and there's a guy with a long gun in a uniform, and he's like, hey, are you a federal employee? And he looks at me, and I'm wearing, like, multicam, looks like law enforcement BDUs. And so he, like, takes a double check, and he's like, are you already registered? Are you here with the federal agencies? Are you here with FEMA? And I was like, no, I'm just trying to find a hotel room for a couple of people that are a mess, and we're going to pull out of the mountain. He's like, no, the whole entire hotel has been booked up for federal employees. And this was, like, one of the only few hotels. And, like, I can tell you exactly the hotel at the exact time, and I can give you the description of the person. Like, I would never lie about anything like this. But that is an example of where priorities are askew, where they're, like, the people that should have hotel rooms are the people that, you know, that was 8-7 days in. We're now 11 days removed, you know, and they're still, unless you are a self-sustained organization, or people that are traveling there are having to lean onto the economy, and there's just no support. There's no power. There's no water. There's no septic. There's no food. It's almost cash only. So it's just a complete mess, and those priorities are wrong. They should have immediately handed over command and control to the largest entity, which have been, like, the United States Army, and then just let us do our thing. But that just wouldn't happen. The governor wouldn't pull the trigger. He would not. He just didn't want to look like he had made mistakes, which he had. But the best thing that you can do when you make a mistake is just own it. Like, hey, man, I messed up. Here, take the reins. Help us. Let's save some people's lives. But it's now too late, and he still won't do it.
Right. And then these people, you can't say they're getting aid when they're not. And the way I understood it, you're there, Tim Kennedy. But the way I understood it, this is one of those disasters where you need helicopters. You just couldn't get there without helicopters. So people like you show up with helicopters, and other people like Jonathan Howard, who I had on Saturday night, who showed up with helicopters, National Guardsmen, and they were telling him, no, get down. We can handle it. You're not authorized. But yet he's the one who saved an 11-week-old baby, brought it back, and FEMA's taking a bow from it.
Everybody that was there just are absolute heroic levels of selflessness. I think there was 30, 45 within 4 days. There was a fleet, you know, of 3-4 dozen helicopters that were all privately owned, all piloted by private pilots. They're coming out of pocket to do everything. These are expensive. You know, we're talking $500 to $1,000 an hour to fly these helicopters just in fuel and maintenance. And It's coming out of their pocket. They're doing it. Operation Airdrop, Mercury One, Samaritan's Purse. The selflessness, and they're risking their lives. I was on this helicopter that we couldn't land. We're up in the mountains. The helicopter pilot takes his bell. He puts the nose on the side of the mountain. One skid is touching on the side of the mountain. And me and this Navy SEAL that I was with, we'll just call him Ryan. He hops off the helicopter with me, and the helicopter takes off. We go down, do the health and wellness check. These people have never, like, they didn't think they're going to ever see another human again. And then he loiters, the helicopter pilot does. He comes back down, puts the nose down. We give these guys some baby formula, some water purification stuff, some power. And they're like, everything else we can survive without. Go find somebody else. Like, the resilience of these people is so incredible. But back to this pilot, he hovers with his nose like inches off the side of this mountain while his rotor blades are, you know, effectively touching the leaves of these trees.
Wow.
So we can climb back on. It's his helicopter. He's putting his life on the line to do this. And even worse is there were moments that we weren't allowed to fly because, you know, people were traveling in, you know, people from the government were taking control of the airspace, and then they were trying to shut down. They didn't want to risk and take the responsibility of what could potentially happen, which was a perceived risk compared to an actual risk. These pilots were doing everything they could to save everybody's lives, and that was incomplete, and sometimes not complete, but in resistance to some of the federal entities.
So in other words, if in the perfect world, you show up there, the hurricane hits on Thursday, you get there on Friday, there should be somebody already in control, in theory, even if they're not physically able to get there yet. So you have someone to check in with, correct? To set up command and control, and there was nobody when you guys beat FEMA there, essentially.
We beat everybody there. And that's the point of Save Our Allies, is that we can, like, there's always gaps, whether, you know, it was the evacuation of Afghanistan, the initial invasion into Ukraine, not what happened afterwards. It's just the first few days. We're nimble. We're expeditionary special operations people, so we're able to get to places very quickly. But that shouldn't be the case. We, especially stateside, where we're talking about North Carolina, like, these things should be rehearsed. These plans should already be in place. There should be systems and processes that all you have to do is say, you know, we're executing this plan. So by the time there's boots on the ground, there's no way that I should be flying from Texas after a hurricane, and we are the ones that are starting to do command and control. Incident command system, like, there has to be somebody in charge, and we need real leaders with real experience, not somebody that's playing some political game and having their own agenda and you know, talking about diversity and inclusion in response to a disaster. It's just madness.
It is. We're talking to Tim Kennedy here, who's been on the ground in North Carolina. So what is the situation like now, and why did it take the Army, why did it take them until last Thursday or Friday to call the Army in? Is that all the governor's call, from what you understand?
Yeah, and again, man, I love the United States military. And they're calling me, like, hey, can you put some, you know, some pressure? Can you? And they were literally just waiting. They're waiting in the wings.
I heard.
Second, the 100.
They had 1,000 guys ready to go.
Just sitting there waiting, bags packed, and they just needed permission and authorization and authority. Those are three things that are very intertwined. And, you know, the budget for the military, that's congressionally approved. And for you to spend or use military manpower, there's certain levers that have to be pulled. And the person holding that lever is the governor. So he has to say, I need support, I need help. And for whatever reasons, mostly politically based, I think he just wouldn't do it. And, yeah, I know there's lots of conspiracy theories because North Carolina is such an important state coming into the election that most of these people that live rural are conservative. I'm not there to discuss any of those things. I'm just there to save people's lives. And I know the people that are in the mountain, as we're making over and over again trips to go pick up more body bags, that we have our priorities wrong. Priority one, save life. Priority two, sustain life by getting necessary resupply missions into these very dangerous disaster level areas. Then you can worry about everything else. Save Our Allies, we're still on the ground trying to do everything that we can, but there is so much more work to be done.
Wow. And right now, do you think that everyone's been reached that can be reached?
No, absolutely not. You know, we're as of yesterday, you saw videos of guys doing swift water crossings to rescue people that are on the other side of the river. The water levels are still very high. All of the roads are still completely broken. You know, we have now infantrymen that are walking through the woods to find cabins. Like, until you've been into the western mountains of North Carolina and Tennessee and South Carolina, like, there are people that very much pride themselves on privacy and resiliency, and they really love to live remote. Well, because of that, in a situation like this, that becomes really, really dangerous. But these very remote places are still very isolated.
Tim, this is a criticism Senator Mark Kelly leveled yesterday. Cut 30.
Folks know that the Trump family at every opportunity uses information, misinformation to lie to the American people. Tom Tillis, I think, you know, said it well, my colleague from North Carolina, that they're, you know, the response has been good and they're doing everything they can to help, you know, folks in North Carolina. It's a tragic situation. It's very difficult for FEMA to deal with this. It's many of these areas are very remote. But I was kind of shocked that for her home state, she's making things more difficult for people on the ground, not sharing the real information.
That's interesting, because this is Tom Tillis, cut 31.
They are beginning to move. I think they're moving a little bit more slowly than I'd hoped. That's why while we're working with the ground, I want to thank all the local, state, federal responders out there. They're doing extraordinary work. But we've got to plus up the resources out there into some of the hardest hit areas that we haven't even reached yet. And I, for one, think that can be done through the leadership of an active duty DOD personnel working with the state and with the National Guard. We just need to surge more resources.
So you can't have it both ways. What do you think?
I don't care if there's an R or a D in front of somebody's name. I know Senator Tillis well. He's put his name on the line. He signed documents for us to get us into places and to give us authorities and authorization. So I'm first going to commend him, but to put his political career on the line to do the thing that he thinks is right for the people of North Carolina. There's no way that you can look at the disaster or the response or the command and control and be like, yeah, this was done well. It's just impossible. And Senator Tillis is correct, absolutely correct. The people and the men and women on the ground are doing everything they can with the resources they have. But those resources were late. Those resources with command and control were broken. Those resources were not allocated correctly, with C2 being handed to the proper unit that has the most power, like the military. He is 100% correct. The first thing that they should have done when they recognize that we're talking hundreds, if not thousands, of deaths, and we're talking tens of billion dollars of infrastructure damage, is like, okay, we need the Army. And if the Army is going to be here, the Army is going to be in control. General Donahue or General George, who are you appointing? And then Yahtzee, we're off to the races and people are doing the work, but command and control is in place. If you don't think the Army can run civilian aircraft, you're just insane. If you don't think the Army is able to utilize nonprofits like ours and Samaritan's Purse and the Red Cross, this is all that they do all over the world in the most austere conflict areas.
And this is just an hour from their base, Tim. It's an hour. They got all the resources.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you're doing a great job. I appreciate the insight. I also think the fact that you're taking time to give information, real information from real life experience, is also invaluable, Tim. It just cuts out the middleman. Tim Kennedy, thank you.
Yeah, God bless you. Thank you for everything.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we got another Hurricane Milton coming up on Wednesday, Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Elon's very outspoken. He's a very independent thinker. So to have somebody like that on your side definitely gets that crowd riled up. The fact that he's back in Butler, he's saying that, you know, those types of events, those types of assassination attempts aren't going to keep him down. He's a fighter. He's going to fight for America. It all really plays in, right, I think, to what I think, as was pretty mentioned, he's going to win. He's going to win Pennsylvania pretty strongly.
And you know what? That was Governor Sununu on with me. And look, he wanted Nikki Haley to be the nominee. He didn't think Trump could win. But now that he sees his campaign come into its own, he's a Republican. He is being an analyst, and he really told me, he's like, look, he told me off camera too, and he mentioned it here on the radio show. He goes, I think they're in a really good place right now. The team is really good, and Kamala Harris is really weak. Now, as Karl Rove pointed out, now he's doing 60 Minutes, doing Howard Stern, doing The View, and doing Stephen Colbert. Good luck with that, because that could easily be a fail. Oprah was a flat-out fail. She's got nothing to say. Nothing's natural to her. And a lot of times, if people are natural, they're bookish, and they're really smart, I don't really mind, because that means they'll do great at the job, they could possibly be great at the job. I don't see either way. I don't see her intellectually curious. I don't see her very adept. I certainly don't see the experience. But the other thing that I wanted you to hear was John Fetterman when it comes to Pennsylvania. He looked at the size of that crowd. Cut 20.
And that's why I'm spending my time in small rooms all across Pennsylvania and red counties. I was in Beaver County yesterday, and later today when I get off with you, I'm going to head to Lancaster, and I'm going to be all across Pennsylvania, because we're going to fight for every last vote. And Trump understands that Pennsylvania picks the president. Our side definitely knows this, and we've seen that happen both in 2016 and in 2020.
So interesting. He knows Pennsylvania's going to be tough. He says don't underestimate Donald Trump's strength. It doesn't mean he's a fan, but it means he's valuable vision. He also knows Pennsylvania. And if he came out as a radical guy who is going to be the taller version of Ilhan Omar, he wouldn't keep that job, and also wouldn't be reflective of the people in Pennsylvania. So, Fetterman's much more formidable than I thought. And in the big picture, I also think Trump will win Pennsylvania.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.